Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 249, The Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom, with Dr. Rick Hansen. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Very succinctly, three fundamental facts about the brain are, number one, as the brain changes, the mind changes. Number two, as the mind changes, the brain changes. In other words, the flows of personal experience leave lasting residues behind, for better or worse. This means, therefore, that there is also a third fact, which is that you can use your mind skillfully to change your brain, to change your mind for the better.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Rick Hansen, discussing the brain as it relates to meditation. Rick Hansen is a neuropsychologist and founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. A summa cum laude graduate of UCLA, he teaches at universities and meditation centers in Europe, Australia, and North America. His work has been featured on the BBC and in Consumer Reports Health, U.S. News and World Report, and other major magazines. Dr. Hansen's most recent book is Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom, which is being published in 11 languages. An authority on self-directed neuroplasticity, he edits the Wise Brain Bulletin, has a weekly e-newsletter, Just One Thing, and his Your Wise Brain blog is on Huffington Post, Psychology Today, and other major websites. He has several audio programs with Sounds True, and his first book was Mother Nature, A Guide to Health in Body, Mind, and Intimate Relationships. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Rick Hansen, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, I've been loving your book, Buddha's Brain. I think it's a real tour de force. And I've been very interested in the patch you've been working in, which is the intersection of all this exciting new information on the brain, positive psychology, and meditation. And you're both a neuropsychologist and a Buddhist meditator. Which came first?
That's a great question. No one's ever asked.
I'm glad I'm off to such a good start.
Yeah, really are. That one just really took me. It's like a koan in a deep way. Oh, let's see. So in the lifespan, I'm 57. I encountered meditation and Buddhism and Eastern philosophy and practice in 1974. So that's about 35 years ago. I was a young pup, 21. Last quarter at UCLA, had 12 units of independent study, and I decided, for reasons that still perplex me, to just dive in to considering something that I'd never engaged before, you know, this whole area of Eastern philosophy and religion. And as soon as I read some of the classics, you know, like Aldous Huxley's Perennial Philosophy, Three Pillars of Zen.
Oh, yes.
Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind,
right.
Alan Watts, the book on the taboo against knowing who you are, Ram Dass and Be Here Now, and a number of things like that.
Wow.
It immediately rang true to me that everything is connected to everything else, everything changes, and if you resist those two facts, you suffer and create harms for yourself and others. And on the other hand, if you live increasingly in harmony with those two fundamental truths, then increasingly you live a life of happiness and benefit for yourself and others. And so that was really the beginning of the process for me, and long preceded neuropsychology. Although I will say, in my mid-20s, I became increasingly interested in the brain, information theory, information processing, and the relationship really between the mind and the brain altogether. But I didn't know enough then, and I don't think, frankly, science knew enough then for that consideration to be very productive in terms of practical tools, which is what my book's mostly about, as you know, practical methods, you know, in daily life when the oatmeal starts to fly. And so it really took, I'd say, about 20 years until about the mid-90s, maybe 15 years ago, when the science began to mature enough and my own understanding and grounding really in Buddhism, which I returned to really about 15 or 20 years ago after journeys in other spiritual traditions, had ripened enough and had grown enough that the intersection between them was fruitful. And no coincidence, you know, my own personal journey, as I think a lot of us experience, you know, the personal is the political and vice versa, right? So my own personal journey paralleled major changes in society in which, as you well know, organizations like the Mind and Life Institute, Time Magazine with a picture of a Buddhist monk with EEG electrodes to his shaven head on its cover, the growing intersection of contemplative practice and neuroscience or contemplative neuroscience broadly, you know, has really come together. And so that's been my journey, I guess, in a nutshell. I will say that to wrap up that, you know, above and beyond, you know, what could be a benefit for other people that I'm interested in, I got to tell you, Dave, it's been enormously personally useful, both in my own meditation practice, to have some growing basic sense of what's happening in my brain, you know, while different things are happening in my mind, and how to use my mind increasingly to nudge my brain, you know, in a good direction. Above and beyond that, it's really been helpful for me in just busy modern life, whether it's dealing with family or, as Jean-Paul Sartre said a long time ago, hell is other people, right?
Yeah, right. You know?
Or dealing with computer madness or Skype that will or will not work, or the daily fire hose we're on the receiving end of media and emails and tasks and stuff like that. You know, learning about how my brain works and coming increasingly to home, you know, feeling more and more at peace and at home and at home in a peaceful place in my own brain has been personally very meaningful and important for me.
Right. In Buddhism, they talk about being a householder, and that's really the place where the rubber meets the road.
Yes.
As you're saying. And I love the way that your book integrates the knowledge that has emerged and this explosion of information about the brain and how well it integrates it with what goes on in meditation. And, you know, there have been so many good books that have come out recently on these topics, and I've had the privilege of interviewing a number of the movers and shakers, and it would have been hard to imagine another good book, you know, another good book that would actually be deserving of being out there as a fresh take on all of this. But I have to say that your book, and we probably should note that you have a co-author, Richard Mindius, and I guess the two of you collaborated somehow in producing this book, but I think it's really a remarkable achievement. So take us through the, you know, there must be another major touchstone, which was actually getting the education of a psychologist. Where and how did you do that?
Oh, well, let's see there. You know, what a long, strange trip it's been, right? So I end up in college in 1969 to 1974. And that was really, I would say, at the point when the human potential movement, as well as the counterculture, really began to be a rising tide. And then in my 20s, I was very engaged in creating and leading all kinds of really wonderful personal growth workshops that did integrate in many ways psychology and spiritual practice with an aim toward the upper reaches of human functioning. So that was my own background. I think of it a little bit like a guy who was a rocker. You know, I had a garage band and I played bars and clubs, you know, in my 20s. And then in my 30s, I thought, you know, I really need some classical training. So I went to Juilliard, which is to say I went to the Wright Institute, which is a really well-known and longstanding institute that trains clinical psychologists in Berkeley, California, it was quite psychoanalytic in its orientation. So I got good classical training, which I really appreciated, you know, the power of good classical training. So that was where I went to graduate school. And one of the things that I got interested in at the same time that I was in graduate school was what happens to couples, and in particular, what happens to women when children arrive. So because our children arrived, literally our son was born during the first month that I was in grad school at the Wright Institute. And so I ended up writing a book for Penguin, which came out in 2002, called Mother Nurture, which is about the long-term health and mental and relational and physical health of a mother, not just during the postpartum period, the first 3 to 6 months after the baby's born. And it's really interesting that subject, which is so important, and also is a subject in which there is substantial research that really talks about the impact of long-term stress and depletion on a subset of women, particularly the more vulnerable ones, and as well as the ones who have the least resources and support, you know, in such a way that it I think leads to a legitimate depleted mother syndrome and so forth. It's really interesting that, notwithstanding the fact that everyone recognizes that parenting, while being the most wonderful and rewarding thing a person, most people will ever do, is also taken as a whole the most stressful and depleting thing, you know, a person will ever do. All that said, it's startling how little attention is actually given to the marathon of motherhood, you know, and how to run that long marathon in a way that doesn't leave you running on empty and helps keep your own cup running over, if you will, so that you can offer, you know, you have more to offer your family. So anyway, that was very interesting for me. And I engaged that for probably about 10 years in a very serious way. I wrote a lot about it. If people are interested, they can go to the first website I did, nurturemom.com. They can also get to all that material on my own website, which is rickhanson.net, S-O-N, rickhanson.net. But anyway, that was a big push for me in the 90s. And then I would say in the aughts, you know, in you know, from the millennium on in the 21st century, at that point I shifted over and I got much more interested in neuropsychology, and in particular kind of, you know, applied, evolutionary neuropsychology.
Well, I think your story should give inspiration to some of my older listeners. I hear from people who, you know, have already had a career or two, and then they catch fire about psychology or some of the, you know, some of these topics, and they're wondering, you know, is it too late? And of course, it's not too late. Well, let's talk a bit about the brain. When I was in graduate school, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth.
Yes.
I remember taking a course in what then was called physiological psychology. And it's been a long time since then, but my recollection was that we memorized the names of lots of structures in the brain, but that not a lot was known about their functioning. And with the advent of fMRIs, you know, that's really changed in the last 20 years or so. And in your book, Buddha's Brain, and also in the talk you gave at Google, which I found on YouTube, you start off with some of the mind-blowing, and no pun intended, or perhaps it is intended at some level, mind-blowing facts about our amazing brains. Maybe you can review some of those for us here about, you know, the size, activity, speed, connectivity, and complexity of our brain.
Yeah, with pleasure. I mean, every time I reflect on that, and I've reflected on it really many, many dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of times, I still anew have a sense of awe and gratitude and responsibility.
Yes.
What we do with this amazing organ. So some of the key facts about it, you know, the technical specs, if you will, it's about 3 pounds of tofu-like tissue. It's, 4.5 to 5 cups of volume altogether inside our skull. But that material contains about 1.1 trillion cells altogether, 100 billion of which are neurons, The other trillion cells are very important. They're called glial cells generally, and they perform important metabolic and support functions, including wrapping myelin, which is insulation, a kind of a fatty tissue like saran wrap, sheets right. of saran wrap, around the long fibers called axons that connect individual neurons to each other, you know, and the wiring circuitry, if you will, of the brain altogether and the nervous system really altogether. So those support cells have very important functions, including, as science is increasingly discovering, some important information processing functions and not just metabolic functions. But where the action mainly is, for sure, in terms of the mind, is definitely those neurons. So 100 billion of them, typically making about 5,000 connections with other neurons, leading to 500 trillion synapses or so. And through those synapses, which are little connections between individual neurons, coarse signals. So neurons fire on the average about 5 to 50 times a second. And a lot of that firing is noise. It's the changes in the firing rate, up or down, that conveys a signal. In other words, that's informative. For example, that, you know, someone is approaching you, or that you really need to, you know, get something done for work today, or as you know, that the light has changed, you know, from yellow to red. That's signals. Those are information. That's what I mean by mind, which is to say the information flowing through the nervous system. Well, in the space it takes for a single breath, let's say, probably about a quadrillion signals moved through your skull. If you think about 500 trillion synapses with, you know, neurons firing 5 to 50 times a second, even some of that firing being noisy, there's still a lot of signaling occurring. So a quadrillion, think about that, 1,000 trillion or, you know, 1,000,000,000,000 signals moving through your head every few seconds. Like, wow, all right?
Yeah, like who counted?
Yeah, exactly. Well, these are ballparks, but they're good close approximations. You know, a lot of life is on the back of an envelope. You know what I mean? And a lot of the important numbers are on the back of an envelope. As they said in graduate school, if you need statistics to see if something's significant, it probably isn't very. You know? But anyway.
That's a good quote. I like that one.
Yeah. So that's the brain. And the thing to get about it is that this object we're describing, you know, these 3 pounds of tapioca pudding between the ears, is doing what is happening right now. In other words, the sensations in a person's tush sitting in a chair, or the sounds coming into their ears, or the meanings of those sounds moving through their own space of awareness. I mean, all that, absent a theoretical, hypothetical, transcendental X factor, all that must be at bottom the operation of the nervous system. So fundamentally, absent a hypothetical transcendental X factor, the mind is what the nervous system does. Now, in terms of causality, it's an important point here. It's much as the brain constructs the mind constructs the brain. In other words, most of the detail of the structuring of the brain is experience dependent. In other words, it is shaped by the flows of life, both beginning in utero, at the point that a fetus, for example, is in its third trimester, its brain is mature enough to learn from experience. For example, the amygdala, which is the alarm bell in the brain, is mature enough, is pretty much fully developed by the 8th month of pregnancy, so that the fetus, in principle, can begin to associate various stimuli with a fear response. So learning can begin. In other words, learning based on experience can begin even in utero, certainly by the point of birth. And as well, it continues. You know, new synapses are forming throughout the entire lifespan. They start forming, you know, during pregnancy, and they continue up to the last breath. And actually, since oxygen is still present in the brain, there's still neural activity for several minutes after the heart stops beating, you know, after we take our last breath. I like to think that even as the lights slowly begin to go out in the mansion of the mind after a person passes away, even then, you know, synapses are forming, learning is occurring, even in those few minutes. So the Anyway, the brain's amazing. And so the takeaway here, I say there are three fundamental facts, you know, about the mind and the brain. The first fact is that as the brain changes, the mind changes. In other words, for better or for worse. I mean, for better, let's say that you have a thicker insula. That's a part of the brain that does both interoception and self-awareness. It also does empathy for the emotions, the feelings of others. So as the brain changes in terms of building synaptic structures and gaining new capillary infusions of blood flows, bringing oxygen and glucose to busy regions. So as the insula gets thicker, a person becomes more capable of both self-awareness, tuning into their body and their own deep feelings, as well as empathy for the feelings of others. On the other hand, you know, if the brain changes for worse, the mind changes for worse, as in something like a concussion or shortages of key neurotransmitters like serotonin, which is very involved, as you know, in regulating mood. You know, the hippocampus shrinks due to chronic experiences of stress, which is associated with diminished ability to form new memories, particularly of context or visual spatial memories. So there's the brain changes for worse, the mind changes for worse. The second fact is that as the mind changes, the brain changes in the ways I was just describing, you know, what's called experience-dependent neuroplasticity. In other words, you know, the flows of information, the flows of mind through the brain sculpt it and leave lasting traces behind. For example, London taxicab drivers have a thicker hippocampus, the part of the brain I just mentioned that does visual spatial memory, at the end of their training in London when they have to memorize the spaghetti snarl of streets than they had at the beginning of the training. Or in more esoteric ways, people who have a long-term mindfulness meditation practice have thicker neural tissues in both the regions of the brain that control attention, which makes sense because when you're meditating, you're really involved in training attention, and also in the insula, which I just mentioned a moment ago, because, of course, they're tuning into their body a lot. In other words, if you stimulate a region of the brain that does a certain function, you will strengthen it, which then takes me to the third fact. You know, the first one is as the mind as the brain changes, the mind changes. Second fact, as the mind changes, the brain changes. That means, therefore, the third fact, you can use the mind to change the brain, to change the mind for the better. And that puts an incredible power in the hands of people at a time when so many of us feel quite buffeted, quite pushed around by major social forces, you know, the economy, the political climate, Al-Qaeda, the world recession, whatever. You know, at a time when so much is kind of pushing us around, it's fantastic to feel that there's an internal locus of control, that there's an increasing efficacy in being able to use our mind skillfully to change our brain and therefore our mind for the better. And that's, for me, extremely exciting. That's what I tried to write about in my book, is a kind of operating manual for exactly how to do that combined with a toolbox, you know, for doing that. And these days, I got to say that without being a, you know, I don't know, a pie-in-the-sky kind of guy, I'm actually quite hopeful that as a growing, you know, critical mass, hopefully, of people in the world become increasingly skillful with this caveman brain, cavewoman brain that's currently, you know, armed with nuclear weapons, as we become more skillful in managing our own brain, we can help tip our planet away from the cliff, you know, that it's racing headlong toward.
Yeah, wow. Now, you know, I'd like to be able to pull out a little audio quote. So I'd like you to say in a sentence that starts with the phrase, three fundamental facts about the brain are, and to outline those three just all in one sentence, if you would.
Sure. Very succinctly, three fundamental facts about the brain are, number one, as the brain changes, the mind changes. Number two, as the mind changes, the brain changes. In other words, the flows of personal experience leave lasting residues behind, for better or worse. This means, therefore, that there is also a third fact, which is that you can use your mind skillfully to change your brain, to change your mind for the better.
Great. Thank you for that. Now, you talked about transcendental factor X, and so there is the question of whether there is a transcendental dimension of what we call, quotes, mind. And in the book, you say this is a question that science can't address, but that you believe there's something transcendental about mind. if I'm not being too personal, what is it that's led you to your personal conviction on this score?
It is really interesting. I always try to finesse this question, and everyone always wants to get at it because, of course, it's the big question. You know, it's said, Dave, that in science, there are three fundamental questions that remain. One is, what caused the Big Bang? Two, what is the fundamental theory that integrates quantum mechanics and general relativity? And three, how does consciousness happen, right?
Right.
Who knows? It could be that at bottom, the answer to all three of the questions is the same thing, you know? So, you know, first off, out of respect, as soon as you grapple with the question of what is mind, I think it's important to appreciate the longstanding philosophical and religious efforts to grapple with that question, you know, and to not simply duck it, but to actually honor it and face it and then figure out what to do about it. For me, my strategy was to face the question squarely, acknowledge that it's really important. In other words, is the mind produced by the meat alone, right? That's the sort of null hypothesis. In other words, that materiality alone somehow, in ways that we don't understand, but somehow produces the mind. By analogy, for example, by the time of Copernicus, you know, the late 1400s, you know, that was what, you know, 500 plus years ago. By 500 plus years ago, educated people understood that the Earth went around the sun. They appreciated the fact that that was a fact, that God was not involved, basically. You didn't need God. You did not need to resort to a divine intervention to appreciate the fact that the Earth moved around the sun. But no one knew how it did it. No one knew what kept the Earth going around the sun instead of shooting off into orbit. You know what I mean? Or began, you know, the solar system in the first place. Right. It took 300 years for Newton to come along with the laws of gravity and, you know, a bit of a first level explanation. And another 200 years for Einstein to come along with the theory of how, you know, mass warps space-time. And so that's what keeps the balls of the planets, as it were, continually twirling around this gravity well of the sun. So long story short, I think in science, it's understood that the default view in science is that somehow the meat makes the mind, right? Even though we don't know how. All right. Now, maybe that's true. But just because there, as the saying goes, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Just because there's no evidence of divine intervention in the construction of mind does not prove that there is no such divine intervention, if you will. That's an important point. So that said, my own personal both experience and understanding of things is that the way I think of it is that if we look closely at the actual nature of the moment of now, right, it's really quite remarkable. I mean, now is infinitely thin in terms of time, right?
Yep.
It is always there. Whatever was in now an instant ago is no longer here. It's no longer in reality. And what's not yet in now does not have any existence, right? It's really quite remarkable. Right under our nose is the most remarkable fact of all, which is to say the nature of now. Now, no pun intended, if you look closely at the nature of now, you can see that the nature of now is that it's emergent, okay? It's obviously very transient, and that what is emergent arises interdependently. But just before, if you imagine now as like a tiny little band that has duration, so there's the leading edge of now and the trailing edge of now, right? As things disappear behind us and things emerge in front of us, at the emergent edge of now, there's actually a lot of possibility, both at the quantum level, because quantum particles, before they congeal, you know, they are fraught with possibility. And at the emergent edge of now, in terms of neural assemblies beginning to cohere into stable patterns that can form mind, you know, which takes about 10 to, you know, 50 milliseconds, thousandths of a second for a real pattern to emerge. I think of these as eddies in the stream, right? So just before the eddy, if you will, of quantum particles coalesces into a clear pattern, and also just before an eddy, a coalition of synapses congeals into a coherent pattern. Just before that happens, there is actually a lot of unconditioned there in the Buddhist term. That's where the unconditioned lives. It's not yet conditioned in the sense of developing a fixed form. And that unconditioned space, if you think of it, in now is eternal because it's always there. It's always eternally possible. And so for me, that is the nature of things. I haven't had to resort to God to describe that. I mean, what I'm saying, a quantum physicist would agree with, a neuroscientist would agree with. This is actually the way it is. This is the nature of the emergent edge of now, in which, very interestingly, there is a complete isomorphism, which means essentially that there's a complete matching of the emergent edge of materiality and the emergent edge of mind as neural assemblies, you know, cohere and into a coherent thought, if you will, right? Well, at that emergent edge of now, which remarkably is the same, whether it's for materiality or mind, my own take is that's where God lives, that God is possibility fundamentally, and God is woven into that emergent edge. My own personal opinion, I'm not offering this as a scientist or a psychologist or a Buddhist teacher. My own personal opinion is that God is profoundly mysterious, you know, beyond human ken fundamentally. I tend to not think in terms of God as the omniscient, omnipotent personality that's embedded in the Abrahamic traditions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. I think of God more in a Vedanta kind of sense as if you will, woven into the nature of things. But for me, when I think deeply about the remarkableness that there is something rather than nothing, you know what I mean? That the universe is here at all, or that the fundamental laws and constants that are woven into the fabric of the universe that enable it to exist altogether, or, for example, have any atoms bigger than helium, which are obviously preconditions for life. When I think about the remarkableness of all that, to me, the notion that there actually is some mysterious, conscious, benign X factor woven into everything doesn't sound that remarkable anymore.
Wow. What a trip you just took us on.
I don't think it's okay. You're really taking me into the deep end of the pool.
Yeah, really. You took us into the deep end of the pool. I was here thinking, my God, what if I become enlightened in this moment and I totally lose it and can't conduct the interview anymore?
Well, enlightened beings are very functional, the ones that have been, and I'm not enlightened yet. So deep down, I think our deep nature is always already enlightened.
Anyway. Yeah, boy. Okay, coming back up a couple of levels.
Periscope.
You say your brain changes your mind. Let's see here. That's not the question I'm trying to get to. There's been an explosion of interest in what's called the plasticity of our brain. And you point out that we've known about this plasticity for 100 years. If that's the case, what's all the renewed excitement about?
Great question. Well, I admit it, really, this side of enlightenment, I have a little bit of a... I've watched psychology. I'm old enough now, you know, to have seen all kinds of, I'm looking for a less pejorative word than fads, you know, but I've seen all kinds of passions come and go. That's a better word. We had Freud, then we had Jung, then we had Reich, then we had the behaviorists with Watson and Skinner, then we had the rebellion against that in the, you know, humanistic psychology of Maslow and Rogers and others, and then we had, you know, the cognitive revolution in psychology, and then we had kind of the, medicalization of the mind with, you know, the advent of, you know, antidepressants and psychotropic meds and so forth. Then we had positive psychology. Then we had, you know, now we have mindfulness coming.
Yeah.
Right? And then left, right, left, right, left, right. And in all that, it is striking to me and ironic that a field of particularly clinical psychology that really has a painstaking interest in the impact of personal history on people, is so ahistorical, you know, when it is, you know, considering its own backyard, right? For example, you know, positive psychology is not a new invention. I mean, that's what Maslow and Rogers and others were up to 50 years ago, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Or you think about the real emphasis now in, you know, the body and nonverbal processes in all kinds of psychology, the somatic psychologies. Well, sorry, that's what Wilhelm Reich was into 80 years ago, you know, and bioenergetics 50 years ago. Yeah. So it's old wine in new bottles. So I tend to be kind of, I try to be careful and intellectually honest about, you know, when am I repackaging in hopefully a useful way, familiar material, and when are we talking about something genuinely new? So with all this passion about neuroplasticity and, you know, oh my gosh, the truth is, it's been understood for a long, 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 long time that somehow the brain had to change in some ways for there to be any kind of new learning, whether it's, you know, learning to ride a bike or, you know, how to do long division or, you know, remembering what happened, you know, something that was important for you that happened, you know, 20 years ago. The brain has got to change. The news, to go to your question, is in the details of how. And that's where it's very exciting because people are increasingly appreciating the ways that the brain changes its structure. For example, I'll just mention some main ways. One is that busy regions get more blood. You know, it's a little bit like a country hamlet only has one or two, you know, dirt roads going to it, whatever. Whereas a busy metropolis has got all kinds of freeways and superhighways coming into and out of it, you know, bringing supplies. Well, the same thing happens in the brain. Second, there are changes in the expression of genes, that's called epigenetics, based on mental activity. For example, people who routinely practice relaxation have improved expression of genes that control the stress response. In other words, they little strips of atoms inside the larger molecule of DNA are unleashed, if you will, to help people manage stress better. Like, wow, mental activity somehow gets down at the level of these strips of atoms, you know, inside a larger molecule, which is still, you know, unseeable with the very best modern technology. Third, in the work, in the famous saying that you know, I'm sure, from the work of the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb, neurons that fire together wire together. You know, I swear I'm going to do a rap song about that someday, but my wife says, honey, we pay you not to sing. But anyway, you know, so neurons that fire together, wire together. That means that repeated patterns, for better or worse, leave lasting residues behind. So I think one of the keys from all this is motivation. In other words, is to appreciate that one's experience really, really matters, not just for its impact moment to moment, but for the lasting residues it leaves behind. And this has made me personally much more careful, honestly, about the themes I allow my mind to dwell upon, including in the background of consciousness, the background of awareness. You know, if you think of the field of awareness like a stage in a theater, you know, what's under the spotlight is bright and illuminated. That's what's in the field of focal attention. But we can still discern what is also on the stage. It's just a little more shadowy. And just the same thing in awareness. Like right now, people hopefully, you know, under the field of focal attention, they're paying attention to this conversation and the meaning of the words and so forth. But in the background of awareness, you know, they're seeing sights or hearing sounds or picking up sensations. Well, in the background of the mind, I think of it in the simulator, the little mini movies that are playing, you know, on the one hand, some of them are like, I've been cheated and mistreated, when will I be loved, right? On the other hand, you know, a different kind of mini movie is let it be, let it be, let it be. You know, you could see why people have to sing. But anyway, the point is that neurons that fire together wire together, even in the simulator, even in the background of awareness. So I've become more attentive to what I let my, you know, just what I let hang out in the field of awareness. You know, the traditional saying in Buddhism is that the mind takes the shape of what it rests upon, for better or worse. So if we rest upon themes of resentment, regret, self self-criticism, hopelessness, despair, limitation, and all the rest of that. Guess what? Neurons that fire together wire together. You know, the brain will gradually take the structure that promotes depression, pessimism, anxiety, shame, low self-worth. On the other hand, if we routinely attend to the areas where we actually do have efficacy, where we really literally are a hammer rather than a nail, if we attend to the good facts, not make-believe, not positive thinking, but the facts that are good in our world and in ourselves, and allow ourselves to feel grateful as a result, if we also stay with those good facts and do what I call taking in the good, which I have a whole chapter on in my book, and dwell on those positive experiences. So we gradually stitch those resources into the fabric of the brain and therefore the self. If we do those things, you know, if we use our minds in those ways, we will gradually change our brain for the better and therefore make a better life.
This is sort of where neuroscience and contemplative traditions and cognitive therapy all seem to flow together.
That's right. I think part of it, what's powerful, is to take away a handful of key points. I mean, one key point is that what's in the field of awareness really does leave lasting residues in the brain. As neurons fire together, they wire together outside of the field of awareness, to be sure. But what's in the field of awareness, and in particular, what's under the focal spotlight of attention, is particularly turbocharged in terms of neural structure. I think of attention as a combination spotlight and vacuum cleaner. You know, it illuminates what it rests upon and then sucks it into the brain, right? Another key takeaway is the importance of really registering positive experiences. You know, the brain is like Velcro for negative experiences, unfortunately, but only Teflon for positive ones, because we evolved a negativity bias to stay alive, you know, in the Serengeti when life was really, really harsh. And it was much more important to avoid sticks than it was to get carrots. Because if you failed to get a carrot today, you know, you'd have a chance at a carrot tomorrow. But if you failed to avoid a stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. So therefore, it's very important half a dozen times a day to really take 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row and savor legitimate positive experiences. That's an important point. Another important point is appreciating the pernicious impacts of chronic stress. Stress, you know, didn't really matter back in the Serengeti when everybody was dead by their 35th birthday, you know. But if people want to live long and well, my dad's 91 and a half and he's got a new lady friend, all right, you know. 91 is the new 71, uh-huh. Or 61, God help us. So the point is we want to live long and well, and stress, you know, particularly chronic, mild, low-grade stress, has pernicious effects on the body and the mind. You know, that again is another important takeaway. And then the last one, I'll just maybe finish up on this point, is that, you know, there's what's called in neuropsychology now the social brain theory. It really appreciates how profoundly social we are as animals and how much love, broadly defined, has driven the evolution of the brain over the last 50 million years, you know, of mammalian and primate, especially primate evolution, and especially the last 5 million years, you know, of hominid, early human, and modern human evolution. Love has driven the evolution of the brain. So it's really important to appreciate the ways in which what happens in the relational field really, really matters in terms of neural structure, and the importance of turning to relational resources, both those that are outside us here and now, as well as those that have been internalized inside us based on experiences with people over time, and to turn to those resources and to use those, you know, and to draw on those resources to help buttress us, you know, against the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, and to build resilience and build optimism and a positive mood. So, still there?
Yeah, you just cut out. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. I was just saying at the very end that, you know, those relational resources can really are critical supplies, you know, in our backpack on our journey through life.
Okay. You know, just stepping back a little bit, you were talking about the importance of what we focus on and how that shapes our experience. And I just wonder about the possibility of a kind of return of Puritanism I don't know how to say it other than that, that a kind of judgment, you know, I like to read crime novels.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
You know, so there's this little voice then that says, oh, am I putting too much consciousness on reading crime novels, or I mustn't see this movie or do that other thing that isn't entirely positive. I'm remembering back in the 70s when Est was very big, and you know, friends would say, oh, don't run that old tape, you know. There's a certain truth to that, and at the same time it seems to me that there's a danger of a kind of Puritanism.
By Puritanism, do you mean a kind of fixation on only good news? Is that what you mean by Puritanism?
A fixation on, yeah, and a fixation on, I guess, a denial of the darker side of existence.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I might use myself a different word, but that's okay. So let's, now we know what we're talking about. Well, I would say that I think that the thrust of neuroscience is to help us appreciate our continuity as human beings with our animal, with our other animal cousins. And an appreciation of the ways in which inside this brain is, if you will, an inner worm, an inner iguana, an inner rat, an inner monkey, an inner caveman, cavewoman, you know, and an inner 21st century human. In other words, inside us are, in terms of, I won't call them dark forces, but there definitely are lower animal factors, programs, structures, processes, and so forth that evolved over, you know, 600 million years. So we share 20% of our DNA with bananas. You know, I mean, if you want to get high and mighty, just remember that, you know, the next time you're walking through the produce department of your local store. So, you know, 98% ballpark of our DNA is identical to that of a chimpanzee. Woo-hoo, you know,
yeah, right.
Similarity there. So I think neuroscience has to help us appreciate the ways in which those forces are alive and well. You know, As you know, one of the chapters of the book is about the two wolves in the heart, which the title comes from a Native American story that says that that basically there are two wolves in every person's heart, you know, one of love and one of hate. And it all depends on which one you feed each day, right? So we all harbor a wolf of hate in our heart. And neuroscience and evolutionary neuropsychology, I think, takes our attention there. And I think that as someone who's, you know, been very involved in spiritual life and has definitely had a toe in the water, if not an entire, you know, leg of the New Age world, as well as definitely a lot of Buddhism, I think there can be a tendency, you're right, to turn away from, you know, really appreciating the reality of aggressiveness, of hate, of envy, of, you know, schadenfreude, of jealousy, of cruelty, of pleasure, you know, and so forth in the human heart. And I think if anything, you know, modern neuropsychology is a corrective factor for that on the one hand. On the other hand, I think modern neuropsychology is really teaching us that if we dwell beyond the point that's productive on negative themes, that harms us and others. The way I think of it is that there are two fundamental mistakes a person can make. You know, on the one hand, they can think there is no tiger in the bushes when there really is one, all right? Or alternately, they can think there is a tiger in the bushes and be afraid of that tiger when in fact there's no tiger at all. Now, Mother Nature wants us to make that second mistake 1,000 times over to avoid making the first mistake even once, right? Because the first mistake has lethal consequences and we don't pass on our genes. So I think the brain in general is hardwired actually to be drawn to the negative, to dwell on the negative. That's why in journalism, the famous saying is, if it bleeds, it leads. In other words, it leads the news hour or it leads the headline story because it's a disaster, it's a problem, it's a murder, it's war, you know, it's some dreadful scandal, it's something like that. So we're very drawn to negative themes, right?
How does that play out then during meditation as the brain then is sort of, as attention is kind of wandering around or...
Yeah. Well, I think in meditation, as in regular life, we tend to be drawn to negative material. You know, you go through a day and 100 things happen, let's say 50 are neutral, 49 are mildly pleasant and positive, one was unpleasant. What's the one thing you think about as you go out and drift off to sleep at night?
Right.
Yeah. So the brain, the brain is Velcro for negative, and we have what I call paper tiger paranoia. We tend to be, most people by default think they live in a world of threat level orange, whether it's at the airport or in their relationships or on their job, right? And so I think that whether it's where your mind goes when you're meditating or where your mind goes in a business meeting or when you're arguing with your mate or, you know, thinking about your kids, it tends to be drawn to the negative. I think both mistakes are important not to make. In other words, I know people who don't deal with the real tigers in their life. You know, they don't address that scary lump under their shoulder, under their armpit. You know, they don't brush their teeth enough. They don't deal with the fact that they really do need to be saving money and not, running up their credit card bills. You know, politically, frankly, think about the days before 9/11, the first 9 months of the Bush administration, where they were getting warnings all over the place that Al-Qaeda was a serious threat, and they just brushed them off because they were focused on other things, including Iraq. That was a situation where people missed real tigers with terrible consequences. On the other hand, of the two mistakes, people usually make the second one much more often because that's Mother Nature's plan. Right? She wants us to be worried. You know, our ancestors, they were all Zen, and they've been listening to the Dr. Dave, you know, shrink wrap radio show, and they're all mellow and all that. Whap! You know, they got eaten. Our ancestors that were nervous and irritable are the ones that passed on their genes, right? And we're their great-grandchildren at the top of the food chain with nuclear weapons today. So, you know, that's our legacy. And I think that, understanding how the brain works can really take us to appreciate the challenges. I mean, from the standpoint of spiritual practice, the brain did not evolve to meditate. It did not evolve to sit quietly for 45 minutes, paying attention to the breath after breath after breath after breath. It didn't do that. So that's why, also in the book, I pay a lot of attention because I'm interested in meditation for the real world. You know, people who are really busy. I think a lot of meditation practices... Yeah, we're created by turtles, for turtles, in turtle environments to become better turtles. But we're jackrabbit world, you know, in terms of the temperamental spectrum. And so how do we adapt practice for jackrabbit householders who have a serious interest in awakening?
Oh, that would be a great topic for another interview. There's so much here that we could touch on that we're running out of time. So let me... as we begin to wind down, let me ask you another question here.
Sure.
You know, you noted that the back and forth swing of the pendulum and that one of the most recent ones is the explosion of interest in mindfulness. And in your Google talk, you say mindfulness is not enough. So
yes.
Why not? What's lacking?
Great question. Well, mindfulness is super important, and by that what we mean is holding some content of awareness, whatever it is. It could be something outside the person, like someone is saying to you, let's say in a difficult conversation with a family member or a friend, or something important at work, holding that content of awareness, which could also include a feeling inside oneself or a thought inside oneself, holding that content of awareness in a large space of awareness. It's a little bit, mindfulness is the distinction between being in the movie, you know, swept away moment to moment in the stream of one's reactions versus being outside of the movie, sitting 20 rows back, you know, in the theater, munching some popcorn, watching what's happening, going, wow, that's intense. Okay, that's mindfulness. Well, mindfulness is critically important, but I think there are fundamentally three major phases in any kind of personal healing or personal growth, psychological healing, or spiritual practice. The first phase is to be aware of what's there. That's mindfulness. Okay, that's an important phase. But at some point, what's there needs to move on, you know? And mindfulness alone can sometimes be enough, but very often people need to move to the second phase, which is releasing what's there, you know, helping it move on outside the door. That's where you and I were trained, Dave, in most of clinical psychology is about the second phase. It's about, you know, letting go of pathogenic thoughts or feelings or desires in various ways, ranging from relaxation methods to venting, cognitive therapy methods, insight, and all the rest. Letting go, releasing, right? And then after we've done that second phase, we need to engage the third phase, which is replacing that which we've released. All right. So, or as I summarize in six words, you know, the first phase is to let be, the second phase is to let go, and the third phase is to let in. All right. All three are important. But even someone as into mindfulness as the Buddha, who among the, you know, elements, the eight elements of the Noble Eightfold Path, identified right mindfulness as a critical element. All right. Even he also identified right effort, which is boils down to essentially pulling weeds and planting flowers in the garden of the mind. So both are important. I think what's happened in both Buddhism in the West in the last 20 years, as well as much more broadly in the culture altogether, particularly the culture of pop psychology, popular psychology, positive psychology, and then the movement of mindfulness into psychology, as well as non-dual psychologies, there's been an enormous emphasis on awareness alone, as if awareness alone is always curative. Often it is, but not always. I see a lot of people who are very aware. I myself am often very aware of thoughts or feelings or reactions that come out of that inner iguana, you know, that inner rat, that inner monkey, that inner caveman, cavewoman, that are not helpful, they're not happy, they're not wholesome, and they don't just go away because I'm aware of them. I got to work with them. I got to do something with them. People have to do something with those things that arise. And it really is helpful to acquire methods to be able to do that. Now, if you skip the first phase, then the other two don't work very well. You've got to start with open, spacious awareness, right? Because that's foundational. You've got to let stuff be. You've got to stay with it. You've got to experience it. You've got to know what it is. You have to bear it sometimes. But then after you've done that, you can help it move along. And sometimes what has to happen for people to do the first phase, by the way, is they need to engage the third phase first. In other words, they need to take in positive resources initially, including, for example, the felt sense of being cared about by others, or the growing internalization of ordinary, simple, mild, positive experiences of daily living, like simple gratitude for the beauty that surrounds us, or for the taste of, you know, a chocolate, you know, cupcake or whatever. They have to do that first to calm the body down, to lower their stress level, and build up the internalization of coping resources for resilience. They have to do that first before they can bear their own experience, you know, before they can tolerate accessing the feelings or the thoughts, you know, that they do need to engage in open, spacious mindfulness as the prelude to helping them release and move on, you know? So anyway, that's how I think about that. And that's how I think about why, you know, mindfulness alone is not enough.
Okay, well, thank you for that. And I wanted to mention that you and Dr. Robert Emmons, who's done research on gratitude, are giving a presentation at Cal Berkeley on October 22nd, 2010. Would you like to say a few words about that?
Oh, thank you for asking. Well, the Greater Good Science Center, as you well know, is a world-class institute at UC Berkeley, founded by Dacher Keltner, who's done a lot of work on goodness, broadly defined as an inherent and vital part of human nature, and as the product of a number of powerful evolutionary forces. So the Greater Good Science Center does a variety of things. It's a great resource for people to know about. And among the things it does is it puts on really neat workshops with really great people that I, frankly, am very honored to be invited into. Dr. Emmons is a leading authority on gratitude, speaking of gratefulness a moment ago. And so at this particular workshop, which is, I think, priced very affordably for people, and they can find out more if they just Google greater good gratitude. You know, those three words will take you right to the link to, you know, sign up for the workshop or at least find out more. You know, we're going to be doing an all-day workshop there that's for the general public that will be both fascinating and practical. And I get to have a very neat hour during that workshop when I will be talking about taking in the good and why it's really important to not just feel gratitude and then have it pass through the mind, frankly, like water through the sieve, water through a sieve, which is the normal reality, but rather to stay with that experience of gratitude and to work with it, you know, in ways that are neurologically savvy, you know, that are brain savvy, so that it really, really sinks in and sticks to your ribs, as it were.
Well, speaking of gratitude, I'm very grateful to have had you on the show. Dr. Rick Hansen, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave, and it's been a real pleasure. You took us all into the deep end of the pool here.
Well, I hope you are as excited by this interview with Dr. Rick Hansen as I am. I deliberately let this interview run long and still didn't make it to all my questions. In the interest of time, I'm going to keep my commentary here short. I do plan to attend the October 22nd, 2010 workshop at Cal Berkeley that he and Dr. Emmons will be leading. I look forward to meeting him in person, and I'm also trying to land Dr. Emmons as a guest for Shrink Wrap Radio. I sometimes hear from listeners that I'm greatly adding to the amount of money that they're spending on books. Well, with apologies, I have to say that I think Rick Hansen's book, Buddha's Brain, is a must-have for anyone interested in this intersection of the latest neuroscience and meditation. It is available in paper, and as I hope you all know, I don't make any money on the books I recommend.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Dave is here to remind you it's all in your mind.
Hello, everybody. You may recall that last time I mentioned I had been invited to blog for Psychology Today's website. Well, my blog is now live on psychologytoday.com, and my blog series is titled The Happiness Dispatch, Briefs from Positive Psychology, Jungian Practice, and Beyond. Well, we went back and forth over this. You know how broad I like to be, but they insisted that I narrow it down a bit. My first blog post is up on the site there, and it's provocatively titled, Did Coke Hijack Positive Psychology? It's basically a reworking of the presentation I did in Prague, and it's the most compact version yet. Do check it out. Actually, my motivation for the blog is to drive traffic to Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel. I can't believe I've taken on more work, though. Now, speaking of the Wise Counsel series, by the time you hear this, I believe I'll have a new interview up there on end-of-life issues with Dr. Hanno Kirk, a therapist in private practice with an extremely interesting and diverse background. You'll find that at wisecounselpodcast.com. And once again, I want to remind Australian listeners about the upcoming Psychodynamic Conference with Dr. Jonathan Shedler. The conference is open to all and will be on Saturday, November 13, 2010, in Sydney, Australia. I've put the PDF of the conference flyer with full registration details on our site, and you'll find it under the promos tab at shrinkwrapradio.com. I've also been asked to announce the 18th World Congress of Viktor Frankl's Logotherapy, which will be held in Dallas, Texas, June 22nd through the 26th, of 2011 at the Marriott Quorum Hotel. Boy, I guess they're working ahead. Don't forget that we also have a store tab on our site where you can purchase 3 archival CDs covering the first 75 episodes of the show, and each of the 3 CDs is just $9.95 plus shipping. And if you need CE units, we have 2 APA-accredited courses where you can earn your units by listening to selected podcasts here. One course is on the wisdom of the dream, and the other is on positive psychology and the quest for happiness. So hope all you professionals out there will take advantage of that. Now, while you're on our site, you'll also find links to discounts at Angie's List, 4inkjets.com, and ShoeBuy.com. I think I had mentioned that I bought some Echo, are they pronounced Echo? I think so, E-C-C-O, dress shoes on the ShoeBuy.com site, using my own discount code of shrink wrap, thereby getting great savings. And the shoes arrived, but of course it's always a challenge for me to get the right size on those European size shoes. In fact, these were too large, but I was able to quickly and easily return them to ShoeBuy.com, no questions asked. So I do feel good about recommending them to you. Now be sure to help evangelize about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends, colleagues, fellow students, relatives, and strangers in the street. I know there's a much larger potential listenership than I've been able to get in so far. Also, don't forget to blog and Twitter about your favorite episodes, or to put a positive review up on iTunes if you haven't done so. There is a new transcript available on the site, thanks to Trish Sebastian for her transcription of number 245 with Sheena Iyengar on the art of choosing. Please let me know if you'd like to help with the transcription effort. As a matter of fact, I'd love to get a transcript of today's interview with Rick Hansen on Buddha's Brain. Thanks to all of you for clicking on that big green donate button on our homepage. Your one-time and ongoing donations help to keep me fired up.
Hi, this is Aftab Umar, practitioner of transformative learning and president of Meridian University, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Well, I'm sure you've guessed by now that my next guest will be Dr. Aftab Umar. We're running a bit long once again, so I'll just read a couple of recent emails. First, we hear from Beth in Erlangen, Germany, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. It's been a long time since I last wrote. Work, my training to be a psychotherapist, and family life keep me pretty busy, although I always find time to listen to your podcasts. At the moment, I'm stuck in bed with the flu, and I have had time to catch up on podcasts and even time to look up new material, for example, websites, Google Books, YouTube, etc. Thank goodness for laptops and wireless internet connections. Hearing your latest podcast with Barry Krako about sound sleep, sound mind was quite serendipitous, as 2 days prior to listening to the podcast, I discovered his name in connection with sleep dynamic therapy. I was looking up information about post-traumatic stress disorder. I think I was searching through PubMed, and his name came up in relation to treatment of nightmares, as often occur in PTSD. I think the therapy was called image rehearsal training. Basically, he gets patients to write a new script for their nightmares. The New York Times article about the therapy raises some questions about whether simply changing your nightmares is such a good idea, as nightmares are often trying to tell us something, and by simply rewriting them, we may be missing important insights. And then she gives me a link to the New York Times article. She goes on to say, "I could imagine it might make for another interesting topic on shrink wrap." The other topic which I wanted to bring to your attention is heart coherence, and as well as the biofeedback methods used to obtain heart coherence as researched by the HeartMath Institute. And she refers me to a video clip on YouTube, which you can find if you search on HeartMath. She said, "I became aware of the concept of heart coherence when I watched a BBC documentary, something about mind-body connection, a few months ago. I'm intrigued by the concept, but afraid it might be just one more gimmicky, money-making scheme. Have you heard of the concept of heart coherence or the Heart Math Institute? I thought it might be a good topic for a future show. This email is quite long now, so I better stop. Thanks for all your hard work and dedication in producing the podcast, and keep up the good work. Cheers, and that's Beth in Erlangen, Germany. Well, let me address your two key points. One is Barry Krako and his rewriting of dreams as an approach to PTSD. In fact, I have done a second interview with Barry, which has not yet appeared on Wise Counsel, but it will be coming, and that is exactly what we'll be talking about. So keep your ears out for that. And in terms of heart math, I certainly have heard of it. I didn't know they had this little biofeedback device that they're selling called the M-Wave. One of my good friends, Dr. Dale Ironson, has looked into them over the years, and he's been quite impressed. So I'll be seeing him later today, and I'll get some opinions from him, and perhaps I will schedule an interview with someone from HeartMath. And here's one more, this one from Japan. Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Jacob James Henry, and I'm a big fan of your Shrink Wrap Radio podcast. I'm currently working in Japan in the learning and development field, and also have an extensive background in music production. I'm interested in pursuing graduate studies in psychology, hence my interest in resources such as your podcast. At any rate, I'd like to offer my services as a transcriber. As you have mentioned, you were looking for volunteers. Please contact me with the necessary information to proceed. Thanks for the informational and entertaining podcast, and hope to hear from you soon. And so, of course, I did respond to that, and I've made an assignment for a transcription, which I'm looking forward to receiving from James. Or is it Jacob? So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to your emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I am ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. Rick Hansen for his sharing of the correlations between neuroscience and meditation. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Dr. Aftab Omer, who is both a local colleague and friend. Dr. Omer is president of Meridian University in Petaluma, California, and we'll be discussing transformative education. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.